P-18. RMXT parking lot, Manhattan, New York. The sky that met Dan McCarthy's eyes from his vantage point at the edge of the RMXT studio's parking lot had, in its absolute entirety, transformed in a manner that inverted or perhaps subverted the alien arrival scenes of old, which so many humans had grown up enjoying within the sci-fi movies and novels of their youths. Unlike in countless stories Dan had seen and read, and even unlike the unsettling moments experienced by millions in Beijing when a squadron warship from New Kerguelen had hovered menacingly overhead, on this occasion, the incoming megaship did not cast the world below into shadow. On the contrary, with night having already fallen in New York, the truly immense level of light emitted from the base of the architect's mothership brought an eerie feeling of daytime. Needless to say, this was a daytime like no other, illuminated by a series of extremely harsh downward-facing lights whose piercing totality was made even more uncomfortable by the cold blueness of the light. The harshness of the bluish light reminded Dan of the hospital corridor he had walked so many times after Henry's accident, with the flickering LED-style lights he could still vividly recall in his mind's ear as well as its eye, despite years having passed since he saw or heard them. Certain kinds of moments and details stuck in the human mind, particularly those experienced during moments of unusual upheaval, stress, or excitement. The hospitalization of Dan's father had been a time of then unmatched upheaval and uncertainty, with the inversion in the relationship happening so quickly when Henry, through no fault of his own, turned in the blink of an eye from the strong and proud man who had taken care of Dan since the moment he was born into someone who would need significant assistance from both of his sons until his rehabilitation was complete, and who would never fully recover even when it was. No one on the streets of New York looked excited as they gazed up at a colossal spaceship that evidently didn't belong to the friendly messengers and looked for all of the world as though it was here to bring carnage and leave death in its wake. Stress levels were at all-time highs, however, with several individuals sadly experiencing heart attacks at the harrowing sight, and some succumbing to their shock to become the first truly innocent deaths to occur directly because of an alien intervention. The craft was so large, its continued descent was hardly discernible. Indeed, only by focusing on the few markings that weren't obscured by the craft's near-blinding downward-facing lights could anyone notice at all, at least for the moment. Those beams illuminated the city that never sleeps with a total light that would keep everyone awake for as long as the craft remained in place. Such was not only their direct visual intensity, but also the nature of what the craft itself represented. Danger, uncertainty, and potentially imminent destruction. The gargantuan warship-like craft was like nothing anyone had ever seen or even imagined, even with the speculative renaissance about other potentially distant alien races and their hypothetically magnificent spacecraft, which had sprung up in recent years. The messenger's small, saucer-like vehicle was by now almost taken for granted, so familiar was the footage from Contact Day and a few other instances, and so comfortable were most humans with the messengers and their placidity, but the squadron's warship had really taken people by fearful surprise when it showed up over Beijing, and it was that craft that had spurred on untold numbers of creative individuals to imagine similar. In happier and calmer days, Dan had judged some of these sketches and more detailed computer-generated models online when Emma advised him that it was always a good idea to stay engaged with people outside of his formal duties within what was then Unica. Dan enjoyed perusing the imaginative creations and felt an acute longing for an ability to draw so that he could have made some of his own. In a million lifetimes, however, neither Dan nor anyone else would ever have been able to come up with anything remotely on the scale, in terms of both size and intricacy, of the craft that now filled the sky above his head, while shining impossibly bright lights down upon him from its equally impossibly intricate base. Although no landing site had yet emerged as that of the architect's choice, and although there was as yet no indication whether a smaller craft would emerge from the mothership's belly, as was the case with the messenger's technology, which had, after all, been provided by the deceitful architects via their radio-based elders, it wasn't lost on those who enjoyed irony and symbolism that the architects were arriving in the skies above New York, as incoming alien forces had in so many of the tales the onlookers were so familiar with. The craft overhead was phenomenally large, to the extent that meaningful size estimates were impossible to discern from any ground-based position. Indeed, not a single one of the untold number of photographs taken in those few minutes and shared online, even panoramic shots, could capture the full craft. The center appeared to be more or less directly over Dan McCarthy's position at the RMXT studio. But since he couldn't see the whole craft, he could only presume this to be the case based on a series of concentric markings on the underside of the craft, which gave the very strong impression that he was looking at the middle. Although the bluish light given off by the craft was so total as to induce headaches in anyone who looked directly at the lights for too long, which in this case, not unlike gazing directly at the sun, was little more than a few seconds, there was a large section of the craft's base directly over Dan's head, which was absent of the blinding beams. This enabled his eyes to pick out some detailed markings, intricate as well as striking, that were remarkable in their own right, if not quite as humbling as the sheer size of the vessel. Alongside the ironic and somehow natural feeling appropriateness of New York being the scene of this remarkable alien arrival, there was a simultaneous irony that these extraterrestrials hadn't chosen as the epicenter of their chaos a landmark like the Empire State Building or UN headquarters, but rather what was on the face of it, a nondescript and unspectacular TV studio. No one was under any illusion that the arriving extraterrestrials were interested in the building rather than the people who had been inside it, however, given that both sides of an argument based around questions about human-alien contact, which had become a hot-button political issue of late, were present. Whether the architects wanted to talk or do something altogether less cooperative and more destructive wasn't yet known. Just like the identity of the aliens piloting the enormous spaceship was unknown to everyone but Dan and his inner circle. Some people thought it might have belonged to some hitherto unknown group from New Kerguelen, who had perhaps been kept from public knowledge because of a penchant for using violence to solve problems that exceeded even that of the squadron. And this very possibility was raised on more than one TV network as the images from New York continued to pour in. Before much longer, however, and indeed after only a few more seconds, every television and computer screen which had been relaying live images from the scene of this most remarkable of all events went black. Networks quickly returned to their in-studio teams, with anchors optimistically suggesting that live pictures would be back imminently. As the enormous vessel continued to lower, reaching a point at which it would soon make contact with the highest of the city's skyscrapers if it didn't grind to a halt, its proximity to the ground had the effect of curtailing all incoming and outgoing digital signals. The only time anything like this had been experienced by reporters like those on the ground in New York had been long ago in Buenos Aires, when William Godfrey, present for both events, had approved of a temporary block to prevent reporters from sharing his reaction to news of the Zanzibar Triangle's discovery. When Godfrey became aware of this architect-caused signal crash, he thought back to the days when a triangular artifact on a beach in Zanzibar had been his greatest concern. And even then, he reflected, he and his staff had been more concerned with managing his public reaction to the news than they were by the news itself. The game of politics and PR was an exhausting one, even for a man who was so well versed in it all and had done so well out of it for not just years, but decades. His recent time with the McCarthys, as trite as it might have sounded to anyone else, had he been the kind of man who would ever openly communicate such feelings, had in a very real sense opened William Godfrey's eyes, and perhaps even his heart, to how much more there was to life than power and prestige. The McCarthys themselves had been forced to inhabit a complicated world that wasn't of their own creation in recent years, but Godfrey's proximity had shown him beyond a shadow of a doubt that they put up with the power and responsibility that had been thrust upon them, rather than ever trying to use what they had to seek more like he had for so long. And like the scheming trio who had sat opposite him in the now empty RMXT studio minutes earlier, would seemingly never tire of doing. But because this signal blocking hadn't been engaged by humans and thus couldn't be disengaged by humans, Godfrey was just as uneasy as everyone else. That unease, already acute, was about to multiply. Lacking either the tact or care of the messengers, whose arrivals, even that of the intentionally frightening squadron force, never caused any physical or biological damage, the architects and their incomprehensibly large craft then began to cause structural damage to occupied skyscrapers, even from their current significant but ever-lowering altitude. No buildings entirely collapsed before the craft reached its stationary hovering altitude, which thankfully happened imminently. But every onlooker knew that some lives were likely to have been lost as the lower section of the craft touched, and in some places crushed, the peaks of the tallest buildings in its vast vicinity. The tragedies looked to be mounting up, one death at a time, and both the scale of the vessel and the fact that its pilots evidently held so little regard for human life grimly suggested to many observers that countless more were coming to collect. A young talking head on one news network, so desensitized by the remarkable special effects which filled the movies and video games that in turn filled his time, spoke rather casually while most others around him lost their minds. A source near the edge of the blackout zone tells me this whole thing looks less like information exchange than destruction delivery. He was happy with the one-liner, but few people watching at home were able to appreciate clever wording when the messages being relayed were so frighteningly stark. Dan's heart was in his mouth, the same mouth his hand instinctively rose up to cover in horror at the sight and sound of some of the city's most intricately constructed skyscrapers being far too literally scraped by the incoming craft. Mercifully, although he wouldn't assume mercy was intended when chance seemed just as likely, since true mercy would surely have seen the craft stop before making contact with any of the skyscraper's peaks, the huge spaceship stopped before any more damage was done. The change in sound was the main giveaway, with the crushed tinfoil noise that had persisted since long before the skyscraper scraping kicked in now being replaced by a faint buzz, not unlike that of a distant vacuum cleaner. "Ah," a deep voice bellowed. "Shit." Dan turned to see Clark, along with Emma and Godfrey and everyone else, not just covering their ears with their hands, but looking as though they were risking applying dangerous amounts of vice-like pressure to their own skulls in an attempt to block out something either deafening or horrific. "Emma," Dan yelled, focusing mainly on her. "Stop it." She couldn't hear, and even if she had, she wouldn't have heeded the warning. The sound inside Emma McCarthy's mind was levels of magnitude worse than anything she had experienced during another sonically challenging moment in Lolo National Forest, to the extent that she was barely able to move at all. "Do something," Dan pleaded with Leisha. The alien, looking ready to cry out of sheer overwhelmed helplessness, looked back at him weakly. "Like what?"